Hi, I'm Mary Beth Brangen.
And I'm James Heddle. We're with the Ecological Options Network.
And we're happy to be with Post Carbon Radio.
Our topic today is what citizens need to know about radioactive emissions from the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan.
Today's title is Precaution, Not Panic. And our new mantra, Learn, Measure, Avoid. Our guest today is Cindy Folkers, radiation and health hazard specialist with the Washington, D.C. area group Beyond Nuclear.
Cindy, tell us about your organization and your work.
Sure. Beyond Nuclear was formed in 2007 to promote non-nuclear sources of energy and to bring to the public information about the dangers of radioactive waste, radiation, and using nuclear power in general, and what that means in the energy realm and the trade-offs that happen when we decide to go nuclear rather than use wind and solar.
There's much disinformation and misinformation flying around the blogosphere these days about Fukushima fallout and the impact in the United States, particularly along the West Coast. So there's a lot of confusing responses, including denial, total denial, and then the opposite, total panic. So could you start with the basics and tell about nuclear radiation and how it affects us?
Okay, so when we use the term radiation, we can actually mean a lot of different things. Radiation, as is given by the electromagnetic spectrum, could include visible light, radio waves, infrared waves, microwaves, some of which are biologically damaging. What we are talking about today, and what is coming out of Fukushima still, is ionizing radiation. Ionizing radiation is so called because when it hits a molecule or a chemical, it can break the bonds of that chemical or molecule, causing it to reform other substances, some of which can be harmful to human cells and the functioning of the human and animal body.
So how do these substances impact us? Do they hit us on the outside, or do they?
So ionizing radiation can impact a human being, and I would like to also include other animals in this as well, and plants, in a couple of ways. You can be exposed to ionizing radiation from the radioactive substance outside your body, in which case you're getting a particular kind of dose, or you can be exposed to ionizing radiation through what they call incorporation into your body. So you've inhaled it, you've ingested it, and it is now inside your body. When it's inside your body, it affects you in ways that if it was outside your body, it would not. And so it becomes more damaging when taken internally like that.
And so what are some of the health effects? And by the way, I think I've seen a lot of studies, including insects, butterflies being affected, for instance, in Fukushima. They've been studied. The insect life looks like it's being really impacted. There's good data on that. But is it just cancer? What all kinds of effects can happen?
Right. So a lot of the standards that are set for exposure look only at cancer effects. But in fact, there are a whole range of effects that can happen when you're exposed to ionizing radiation. So we see that after Chernobyl, there are a number of deformities, sometimes very subtle, but it doesn't mean that they don't impact the organism. We see it also in butterflies after Fukushima and other insect life. And what it does is, if you have radiation that you're exposed to over generations, over time, it can build up in an individual, and the damage is cumulative. But it can also build up in the genetic material. And that damage is also cumulative. So you've got a cumulative damage in an individual and a cumulative damage over generations. And these are health effects that are not accounted for. In fact, they specifically avoid accounting for these effects. And these are the ones that can be the most deleterious over time for any number of populations.
I just wanted to also say, to ask you to bring up, that is why little girl or children are,
And it just so happens that children are particularly susceptible to radiation damage. So a child is many, many more times susceptible to radiation damage than a reference man. And what is reference man? Well, reference man is used by the standard setting bodies who tell you how much radiation a member of the public or a worker can be exposed to. And what ends up happening is they take standard man and they mix him with a lot of other people in the population, all of which are more sensitive than standard man. So what they've done is they've diluted the protections for those that are the most vulnerable, like children, especially female children, like female adults who are also more sensitive than standard man, and those who have immune issues are also more sensitive.
And elderly too, I believe.
Elderly also, in certain ways, yes, they are more sensitive as well.
And the standard man, what is a standard man? It's a strapping 20-year-old or what?
Yes, a standard man is usually about 30 years old, about 70 kilograms, which I believe is about 130 pounds, 6 foot or so, and fairly healthy. So that's the standard that they use. And really what that applies to more is even in workers, nuclear workers, is a very narrow range of people. But that's who the standard was originally set for. And what they tried to do is to make the standard more applicable. But what they've in essence done is they've watered down the protections for those who are most vulnerable. If they really wanted to protect the population, they would focus on those that are the most vulnerable. They would pick the most vulnerable population, the most sensitive disease, and that is what they would protect for.
Not to mention the embryo growing in the womb, that they're very, very, very susceptible to their growth processes being disrupted at that time by radiation, isn't that correct?
Right, so what happens is any time, and this goes for children that are growing fast but who have been born, and it also goes for embryos, those folks, those population members are much more susceptible because of the rapid cell divisions they're undergoing. It's just a lot of probabilities that the more damage they would absorb from radiation exposure, the more of a chance there is that something would go wrong developmentally. So that goes for a developing fetus, as well as it does for children who are having growth spurts.
I wanted to ask you about, there's so many people, particularly in the pro-nuclear people, who are completely dismissing and poo-pooing the effects from Fukushima and the fallout, and that it would have no effects by the time it would move out of Japan, that only the Japanese people are going to be affected by this, and the Japanese people we know are being very affected by this, and our heart goes out to them. And what would you say to those people who dismiss the risk to others?
Well, I think that they think they might have a crystal ball. I mean, honestly, who can predict exactly what's going to happen? This is why we have to be vigilant. We have to measure the levels of contamination here and in Japan. We have to be very careful about the food supplies. We have to understand where the cesium and other radionuclides might be traveling in our environment and watch for hot spots. right? Places that collect radioactivity for some reason. Because if we don't remain vigilant, we could get some very nasty surprises. At the same time, we can find out what isn't contaminated and go ahead and rely on certain food sources. But we can't know any of that without measuring and monitoring. To not measure or monitor our food stocks is really to come from a place of ignorance. So when the industry says there's no worry, that's fine for them to say that. What is their objection to us testing?
Well, now you hear a lot of talking points from pundits who poo-poo any real damage, and they say, oh, it's like traveling across country in an airplane, or like eating a banana, or having a chest x-ray. How do you respond to those kinds of statements?
Well, first of all, the x-ray, the plane flight, those are all external radiation. So I would go back to my comments that I made earlier about the difference in biological impact between something that is inhaled and ingested versus something that is outside of your body. However, I would also add that there are naturally occurring radiation, radioisotopes out there, polonium-210, so there are naturally occurring radionuclides out there. Polonium-210 is one. Potassium-40 is another. And these are, they pose a certain amount of risk. Sure, they do. But just because they pose a certain amount of risk and they're naturally occurring doesn't mean that anyone has the right to expose us to more risk from man-made radiation. And in fact, there are some biological impacts of biokinetics of some of these naturally occurring radionuclides that are not similar to the man-made radionuclides like strontium-90 and cesium-137. And so until we can fully understand what those impacts are and how each radionuclide travels in the body, where it goes, how long it resides in the body, how much of it there is, we really shouldn't be making a comparison between one or the other without studying each one for its own biological pathways and for its own impact, because we could be quite surprised that some of them would be quite different.
Well, some of these radionuclides mimic other substances which are not radioactive that go to the muscles or that go to the bones. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So it is a favorite comparison of people who are nuclear proponents between cesium-137 and potassium-40. And the reason that they do this, there is a reason for this, is that cesium-137 is treated in your body like potassium. And there is a certain amount of potassium that's radioactive, although it's a very, very small percentage, less than 99% of naturally occurring potassium is radioactive potassium.
So it will... Less than 99%?
Yes. It's a 0.017% or a 0.0017%. I can't remember exactly. Small fraction.
I see.
Yeah. So not only is it very little, but it is within an equilibrium, not only within the potassium that occurs naturally, of which it is a part, but also within your body. So you could ingest 10 or 20 bananas, and you'll have a bit of a range. Maybe it'll increase a little bit, the radioactive potassium in your system, sure. But it'll pass out pretty quickly. And in general, you will not exceed a certain range of radioactive potassium in your body at all. Whereas, if you have cesium-137 replacing non-radioactive potassium, then you have a problem because you have added to your dose because it's replacing something that wasn't radioactive with something that is.
And what about background radiation? We often hear people say, oh, well, it's de minimis because it's only a small fraction of normal, natural background radiation.
I really have a quibble with what they're calling background or even natural background radiation these days. It used to be that natural background radiation was about 80 millirem per year. Millirem is the measure that they use for the damage that you would receive from radiation exposure. It's a unit of measure, a millirem. Now they're saying that we're exposed to about 620 millirem, but they're calling it background. They're not calling it natural background. And so I think what they're doing is they're slowly raising the amount they say we're being exposed to naturally, is part natural background is part of that, but also radon is part of that, and not everybody is exposed to radon. Medical tests are part of that, and not everybody gets ionizing radiation medical exams. So you see them compounding the dose and turning things into background radiation to make it sound okay, when in fact there's a lot of question as to whether or not it is background radiation. It's that our background radiation is at that high of a level. And in fact, if you look at the amount of they say that we're exposed to, which is 620 millirem per year, and you add to that the 100 millirem per year that the NRC wants to expose us to in addition, you reach the level of background radiation that this Earth experienced when the trilobites were evolving. So this begins to raise a really important question. And it was termed, I believe it was K.Z. Morgan that says, with adding radiation to our background levels like this, like the nuclear industry does, are we reversing the birth of life? And I think that that's a very important question to start to ask. It could be that the NRC, who says we're exposed to 620 millirems a year, is just simply mistaken and we're not exposed to that much. But if we are being exposed to that much, we better certainly account for it, because that is a huge amount of background radiation according to the evolution of the Earth.
And so are they including in that figure the amount that was added by the above-ground nuclear test, all those hundreds and hundreds of above-ground nuclear tests over the period of years?
If they're including the above-ground nuclear tests, there's a good chance that they're not including the incorporation of those nuclides into our system. So what they would be talking about would be a background dose external. Again, the difference between an external dose and an internal dose. In fact, what they're including in that number is somewhat amorphous when you get to questions like that. And so what they've done is kind of an insidious thing. Have they included the background, in the background number, their releases over time to make them look like it's okay to have that much radiation in the background?
Well, I wanted to ask you about, so how would we get affected by fallout from Fukushima? Do you think that it is possible for us to... Do you think it is necessary to take precautions about the possibility of fallout from Fukushima?
I absolutely think it's necessary to take precautions about any fallout from Fukushima. I think it's necessary for the fallout that has reached our shores in the U.S. I think it's necessary for any imports that come here from Japan, considering that our limit for cesium, radioactive cesium as food, is 12 times higher than theirs. I also think that it's necessary because we're not just exposed to radiation from Fukushima. And for a number of years, ever since the beginning of the atomic age, particularly when they started to do above-ground nuclear testing, we are having exposures from a number of different sources, not just Fukushima. So we need to start looking at all of these sources, routine releases from places like San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, and every single nuclear reactor, accidental releases from those same nuclear reactors that they allow but really aren't considered routine, above-ground bomb tests, and all the medical exams that we get, and the naturally occurring radiation as well. So it is necessary to start to protect ourselves more and be more aware.
Actually, just recently there were... there was an alarm because someone on YouTube had a video measuring really high readings on a beach in Half Moon Bay, and then there was another one in another beach. And it turns out that California's beach line has a lot of naturally occurring thorium and radium. And who would have known? It's very interesting now that we're on the alert for potential Fukushima radiation, that we're learning about the naturally occurring sands and rocks that maybe we wouldn't want to have our children playing next to if we knew about them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important, for example, with, like you were saying, with the person who discovered the naturally occurring radiation in levels that were quite high, remembering that naturally occurring radiation also carries some risk. It is good to know these things. It is always good to have more knowledge, because I find that having more knowledge, for me anyway, gives me a certain amount of power back in my life where I can make a better decision. Maybe I'd be okay with my child playing on that beach as long as they didn't ingest the sand. Maybe I wouldn't. But I sure would like the chance to decide that for myself. And I think that it's extremely important that people make their own decisions, not from a place of fear, but from a place of knowledge and understanding. Because that is extremely important, and that is power.
So really, informed precaution is to be preferred to uninformed panic.
Absolutely. Informed precaution and the choice that you've made for yourself and your family versus uninformed panic is always better. Informed precaution is always better.
Well, now the fact that governmental agencies and international monitoring agencies are not doing their job, are not monitoring the fallout from Fukushima, has stimulated a grassroots movement of citizen monitors. Who are getting themselves organized, like safecast.org or radcast.org. Mm-hmm. But it's a steep learning curve. There's a lot of precision required, standardization of measurement techniques and protocols. Mm-hmm. What can you tell people about some of the most important things to keep in mind when they're joining this monitoring movement?
Personally, I think that one of the best things to do is to monitor the food. And when one is monitoring food for radiation, it's a completely different set of protocols from when one is monitoring radiation in the soil or radiation from stones or sand. It's different instrumentation, it's different calibration, it's different shielding. Just technically, it's much more, as you say, precise, much more detailed to have to monitor food for radiation. And so I think that it's very important that the measuring devices be as standardized as possible. I think that it's also important that a protocol for measuring be set up and that people understand what that protocol is and follow it and ask questions. When it comes to this kind of thing, there is no stupid question, right? So people need to take the responsibility to ask proper questions and inform themselves, figure out what kinds of monitors work best for what it is they're looking for. And it's not going to be the case, for instance, that a handheld radiation monitor is going to be able to tell you what is inside of your food, what kinds of radiation or radionuclides are inside of your food. That's going to be a much more involved process. However, if the food is very contaminated on the outside, your handheld would probably pick that up. If it's very contaminated on the inside, there's a chance it'll pick that up. But you're dealing with contamination levels, in the case of, say, cesium inside an apple, right? That would be very, very difficult, if not at all impossible, to check with that handheld. So you really need to take other measures in order to measure that. And it would take longer time. It would take proper shielding to take that apple and measure whether or not it's got radioactive cesium in it, for instance. And it also matters about the isotope. If you're looking for strontium-90 inside an apple, that is yet again an additional level of detail and procedure for monitoring. So it is complicated, yes, it's true, but there are experts out there who sort of know the ropes and who are willing to help and educate. And so getting protocols, getting proper equipment, understanding what it is that you're looking at and asking the proper questions and knowing the proper questions to ask, that's what we need to do. And I am all for independent monitoring. In fact, I'd almost prefer it to having the government monitor, because at least then we know what the protocols were. It is completely, or should be, completely transparent, the kind of equipment, the kind of protocols. And so it's very, very important that citizens take this on.
Well, actually, speaking of the government monitoring, EON, the Ecological Options Network, together with Citizens for Health and your organization, Beyond Nuclear, submitted an official document to the FDA that recommended strongly that they monitor food and also to lower the permissible levels from 1,200 becquerels per kilogram to 5. Can you talk about the term biomagnification and bioaccumulation?
Sure. So I want to speak a little bit to the FDA petition first. So we did want to give, through the coalition, Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, we wanted to give the FDA the chance to do the thing that they should be doing, which is monitoring food. And we certainly want them to lower the internal contamination limit, particularly for children. As far as I know, the U.S. limit at 1,200 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and or 137, so it's any combination thereof of the radioactive cesiums, is the highest in the world. Canada is 1,000 becquerels per kilogram. Europe is 300 for children, 600 for adults, but goodness only knows how they think they're going to differentiate the children's food from the adult food. That, to me, is a dicey proposition at best. And all of those limits, Japan is 100 becquerels per kilogram, all of those are too high, right? And the reason that we suspect that they're too high is because there was a Belarusian doctor by the name of Dr. Bandashevsky who did studies with children where he took their internal, their incorporated body burden of radionuclides, cesium-137, and he equated that with the amount of disease, with the types of diseases and the severity of those diseases. And he found that at just above 10 becquerels per kilogram of incorporated radiocesium, these children began to have heart problems, mainly arrhythmias, and hormone imbalances. When that incorporation limit of cesium in children got up...
You mean by incorporation when they eat it?
Eat it. In this case, it was probably all being eaten, but you could also have inhaled it as well. Mm-hmm. It depends on where it goes in the body, and when you eat in something, it might go different places in the body than when you inhale it, so we'll say eating it. When these children were, when these children had body burdens of 50 becquerels per kilogram, 50 becquerels per kilogram of radiocesium, they started to experience permanent tissue damage to vital organs. That's lower than any of the standards that I've seen, even Japan's. So the question is, who are we protecting? Are we protecting our children? Or are we protecting the nuclear industry? And I think that's a really good question. Okay, now what was the second thing that you asked?
Bioaccumulation and bio.
Thank you. So bioaccumulation and biomagnification are actually two different things, but they're sort of on the same coin. So they're like two sides of the same coin. So bioaccumulation is, let's take radiocesium, for instance. Bioaccumulation is when it starts to collect in the environment through natural processes. Biomagnification is when the entities in the environment start to pull the cesium out, and like the fish start to eat the plankton and another fish eats the fish that ate the plankton, and then you go up and up and up and up the food chain. That's biomagnification. So humans who eat eggs, fish,
tuna, for instance, on the top of the ocean.
For instance, the top of the food chain.
In the ocean.
By the time the top of the food chain eats these other creatures or substances or sea life, sea vegetables that have bioaccumulated the cesium, it starts to biomagnify, which means that the environment in which you exist or in which the fish exist is actually, like the ocean water, is actually a lot lower in cesium concentration than the fish itself. And we see through studies that have been published that the biomagnification of cesium in fish can be 2 to 40 times higher than the ocean water or the water in which they exist. And it depends on, you know, the salinity of the water as to how much they biomagnify, the type of fish, does it dwell in the water, where does it dwell in the water, does it dwell, you know, does it, is it a bottom dweller?
No,
so there's a lot of variation to this, but in almost all cases the fish are going to be higher in cesium than the ocean water that surrounds them.
I've seen scientists quoted in articles saying, oh, the cesium is flushed out of the flesh of the fish by just swimming around, and it's not going to be a problem.
That might be true at the beginning of an accident where, for instance, in Fukushima, the cesium is in the ocean most highly concentrated right around the facility where it was dumped, or maybe a few miles out. But as that moves through the ocean and disperses, that tuna also is going to move through the ocean and disperse, sometimes more collected in currents, sometimes not. And again, these are the ways that cesium moves in the environment that are not exactly clear to us at this point. But if the cesium is traveling across the ocean and the tuna is traveling across the ocean, the tuna is going to be bioaccumulating that whole way. So you might be able to make the argument that if the cesium stays in one place and the tuna gets cesium from that place and then starts to swim across in a clean ocean environment, maybe the cesium will wash out. But if you've contaminated the whole ocean and the cesium starts to reaccumulate in various places, I wouldn't bet on it.
And now we're finding out that the explosions and the meltdowns in Fukushima wasn't a one-time event, was it? It unfortunately seems like it's going on, well, it has gone on, daily, the emissions into
the releases.
The releases into the ocean and into the air.
And they've been lying about how much. Lying, mistaken, I don't know, I'm going to start to call it lies because it's been, they've been so wrong so often and they've been so misleading that I start to wonder if it isn't on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with the strontium 90 release that they had recently. We had an expert tell us that it could very well be that we've now got a 1-to-1 ratio between strontium 90 and cesium. And if you think that cesium is a problem, and believe me, it is, strontium is many times worse.
Why is that?
Because it's got a higher, what they call specific activity. What that means is per gram in comparison with cesium, it's much more radioactive. Strontium, your body mistakes strontium for calcium. So anywhere that calcium goes in your body, strontium will collect. That includes the bones, the teeth. The bones have bone marrow. They're important for new blood cells, and they are also important They're important for new blood cells, and that is where leukemia starts.
Now, knowing what you know and knowing that there's an organized system of unaccountability in this issue, what keeps you doing this work?
Oh, I think we can come out the other end of this better, more informed, stronger. I think that by opening our eyes to exactly how horrible they have been to us over these years, the industry, right?
Which industry?
Nuclear industry, yeah. How much they've tried to obfuscate the truth and cover up how much the radiation, especially incorporated radionuclides taken internally, damage us. I think that we have a real shot here to get rid of the nuclear power reactors and to move to clean energy sources. And I think that our children's health is going to be what causes us to do that. And I think that understanding how radiation from man-made facilities like nuclear power reactors, even regardless of an accident, how they continue to release this stuff as a matter of operational course, that the more we learn about that, the more we see that we need to take real advantage of alternatives like wind and solar.
So how can people find your site and get more information?
So if they want more information, they can go to www.beyondnuclear.org, all one word, and we have just a whole bunch of information that they can make use of. And we encourage them to call us as well. Give me a call. If you have questions or concerns, I will answer them as best I can. And most importantly, unlike the nuclear industry, I will tell you when I don't know something.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
There are a few things that people can do to respond to this Fukushima fallout and to the increasing radiation in our daily lives. What we mean by learn, measure, avoid is to learn about the more, as much as you can, about the nature of radioactivity and how it shows up in your body, as well as measuring devices and joining with other groups to measure food, water, and air. As an addition to that, we also, and Bing Gong, co-host of Post Carbon Radio, is organizing an effort to send in samples of ocean water to be tested for radionuclides from Fukushima. And if you're interested in becoming involved with Bing Gong's efforts to monitor the ocean water in West Marin, you can contact him by emailing him at binggong@sonic.net. The other thing that you can do is get involved with bringing resolutions to your city council and in Marin to the county and having them, in this effort, get more educated about the problem and also educate the council members and the rest of the public. We have online, you can get it through EON if you want to send an email to info@eon3.net. We'll send you a template for a city council or a county resolution. We also, and we have already passed that in the city of Fairfax here in Marin County. So these are some of the many, many things that you can do to empower yourself and get involved.